Mrs. Jones. He's well known to the town. And he begins by saying, "You know me, don't you, Mrs. Jones?" And she says, "Yes." And before the prosecuting attorney could continue, she carries on. "I know that you cheated your way through high school and through college. I know that you're having an affair on your wife. And I know that you're a nobody who thinks he's a somebody and is willing to step on everybody to get his way up in the corporate ladder." And the prosecuting attorney was a bit taken aback by this and stunned and not knowing what to do. He pointed to the defense attorney and says, "You know him too, don't you, Mrs. Jones?" And the point is that we're all a little bit like that, don't we? Every now and again, I've learned not to let my imagination run too far away from my restraint. But every now and again, I terrify myself with the idea that I'm going to wake up one day in the morning and above my head is going to be this kind of floating plasma screen TV, which is just going to permanently display everything that I'm thinking. It's a terrifying thought, isn't it? Just think about that for a moment, that everywhere you go, everyone you speak to is going to know what you're thinking. So there's no getting around that one. The fact of the matter is we're all guilty. We're all guilty. And the problem for Christians, most of the time, I think, the greatest cause of guilt for Christians is that we fail to live according to the faith that we have in the good news of Jesus Christ. We fail to live according to what God has promised us. I was watching another show about lawyers called Suits. It's quite a new series. And in one of the episodes, one lawyer says to his boss that he's losing a case and he needs the company to invest $1 million into, I don't know what it went for, I couldn't really understand that part, some legal issue, but they needed $1 million for him to research something to win the case. And she ums and ahs the boss about this and says, "That's not really going to be possible." And he says, "Don't you believe that I can win this? Show me some faith and give me the money." And she replies by saying, "Harvey, you can have my faith, but not my money." And so often I think the temptation in the Christian life is to do that, is to say, "Lord, you can have my faith, but you can't have my money. You can't have my obedience in this area. You can't have my confidence when times get tough." And I think this is the issue facing our character in the story, Isaac, is that times get tough for him. His faith is put under pressure, and the temptation for him all the time is to say, "You can have my faith, but not really." We've heard that story about the tightrope walker. I know we all know it. And it's I always get confused between the Zambezi River. So there's a tightrope that and some other river, and I can't remember which is the actual river. But there's a tightrope walker, and he's got a tightrope tied from one side of a river to another with the waterfall just in front of him. And he dazzles his crowd by going across and coming back, and he gets their applause, and then he commits some daring feats and cartwheels and handstands along the tightrope, and everyone applauds, and then he takes a wheelbarrow across and everyone thinks this is great, and then he comes back and he says, "Do you believe I can take the wheelbarrow across again?" Everyone says, "Yes, yeah, of course you can, we've seen you do it." And he says, "Well, anyone willing to hop in?" And the crowd's like, "Yeah, that's great. You know, they would love to see someone get in there." And he says, "Right, I need a volunteer." And of course, not many people come forward. This is Isaac. It's one thing to say we believe in God. It's one thing to trust God when things are going relatively well for us. But when we're under pressure, how do we respond? And Isaac gets put under pressure of three high-pressure situations in this passage. I wonder if you notice. So the first in verse 1 is the famine in the land. So 26 verse 1, "Now there was a famine in the land, besides the earlier famine of Abraham's time, and Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, in Gerar." The Lord appeared to Isaac and said, do not go down to Egypt. So Isaac was passing through that area to try and get to Egypt. And I think the rationale is that Egypt was a big place, a big city. They would have had greater crops, been able to store more food. They also were by a delta in the Nile River, which would have increased their ability to cultivate and fertilize crops. And so that was the place to go. When the ancient Near East was in famine, you go to Egypt. But God stops him mid-journey, and there's nothing wrong with that, by the way, so just, that's not in itself wrong. It's good for us as Christians to evaluate and make wise decisions based on reason and responsibility, and there's nothing wrong with that so far. God says to him, stop, don't go down to Egypt. And this is the first time God appears to Isaac directly. So up until now, it is known that Isaac is going to be the one through whom God continues his line of blessing. So we've seen God make this promise to Abraham, through I will bless you, and through you all nations of the earth will be blessed. And Abraham has known that. And Abraham has known that Isaac is the one that God will continue that line of blessing, but Isaac has not yet ever had the Lord appear to him directly. But it happens now. In this time of crisis, as he's going down to Egypt, the Lord appears to him, and in verse 2 we see, do not go down to Egypt, live in the land where I tell you to live, stay in this land for a while, and I will be with you, and I will bless you, for to you and your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will confirm the oath I swore to your father Abraham. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give them all these lands, and through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed me and kept my requirements, my commands, my decrees, and my laws. So Isaac stayed in Gerar. And we've seen these before. These are the exact promises made to Abraham. This is God's great plan, or the early seed of it, as to how God is going to fix the world. And we'll come back to that later on. It's not just about land. It's not just about descendants. We've seen that this is the promise that ultimately goes all the way through to the new creation because of the work that Jesus does on the cross. This is the beginning of the gospel. And it's now passing on to Isaac. And Isaac's response in verse 6 is encouraging. So Isaac stayed in Gerar. In other words, he does what God says. So Isaac's put under pressure. But so far, he's willing to put his money where his mouth is. That's an encouraging start for us. Encouraging start for God's people. But then the second situation comes along, the second high-pressure situation, which is when he gets to the king of the Philistines, to Abimelech. And suddenly the second situation of fear of man, fear of what a man can do to him, puts his faith under pressure. So in verse 7, in verse 7, when the men of that place asked him about his wife, he said, she is my sister. Because he was afraid to say, she is my wife. And this is why. He thought the men of this place might kill me on account of Rebekah, because she was beautiful. She was beautiful. Now my Old Testament lecturer at Oak Hill tells me that the idea of her beauty may not necessarily simply refer to her outward appearance, but the more generally could just be saying that she is attractive. In other words, she is an attractive prospect for marriage. She's wealthy. She comes with Isaac. Anyone who could marry her would get all of Isaac's belongings. So in some sense, whether or not it's just because she's a looker and someone might want her and want to kill Isaac in order to get her, which is quite possible, I suppose, or whether or not someone thought she would be an attractive prospect for marriage to make some sort of an arrangement with, equally possible. But the idea is that if I'm her husband, then they have to kill me to get to her. If I'm her brother, well, then all they have to do is make me an offer I can't refuse. In other words, I'm not in danger. Well, never mind his wife, who then has to go off with the man who makes the attractive proposition, but that's, I suppose, not the forefront of his thinking. The forefront of his thinking is, I need to survive. Now, it's not just the fact because if we remember that we've just had this personal revelation from God, God has just appeared to Isaac for the first time directly to say, I'm going to be with you. Stay here. That's what I want you to do. I'm going to bless you. And he responds well, but then another bit of pressure comes and he caves. And it's not just his lack of faith that God will be with him and God will protect him. It's the fact that what he's doing is actually putting the promises in jeopardy. Because remember, the promise is not only to Isaac, but to his offspring. And remember, Rebekah, Isaac's wife, is the one that God gave to Isaac. Quite extraordinary. We looked at the way God did that a few studies ago. God brought Rebekah to Isaac in a wonderful way. And here Isaac is putting her at risk. If she is not his wife, how does the promise line continue? So it's more than simply acting in unbelief. It's actually acting a counter against God's promise. So things start to look a little bit more sketchy. But then, of course, the scene goes on for a while. So after they'd been there a while, in verse 8, Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, looked down from a window and saw Isaac caressing his wife Rebekah. And Abimelech, being a smart man, realizes this could be one of two things and realizes what Isaac has done. He's lied about her being his sister. And then he reacts in quite a surprising way. So Abimelech summoned Isaac and said, "She's really your wife. Why did you say she is my sister?" Isaac answered him, "Because I thought I might lose my life on account of her." And then Abimelech said, "What is this you have done to us? One of the men might well have slept with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." So Abimelech gave orders to all people, "Anyone who molests this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." That's an extraordinary reaction, isn't it? If you lied to the king, I mean, there were no high courts that would have brought the king to justice if he just decided to put someone to death because he didn't like him. That's not the way it worked. If you were a king, you could pretty much do whatever you liked. So how is it that Abimelech turns out to be this really moral character who just says, why didn't you tell us? Well, you would have brought guilt upon us. We would have been in trouble with God if you had let this lie persist. It's a good thing I found out when I did. But then you go back to an earlier chapter. Chapter 20. And then we realize that, hang on, this whole scenario has happened before. In fact, not just in chapter 20, but in chapter 12. Abraham makes a lie about his beautiful wife, Sarah, to the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, because he thinks that on account of her, he might die. So in chapter 12, Abraham uses the same line. And then in chapter 20, he does the same thing again, except this time with a king named Abimelech. Ring any bells? The same king in the same region. Now, it might not be the same king. It might be the king's son or nephew or one of his descendants that has the same name. But we're not given any differentiation that it is a different king, even though our passage is careful to let us know that this is not just an accidental duplication of a story, but they got the characters wrong, as some commentators suggest, that this was a mistake. They just accidentally duplicated the same story, different editors at different times, and they just got the characters all mixed up, and that's why it says Isaac and not Abraham in the story. But look at verse 1. In chapter 26, "Now there was a famine in the land besides the earlier famine of Abraham's time." Our author is very careful to let us know that this is a different famine. It's not a mistake. It's not a false duplication. This is an event that took place similar to Abraham's time, but different. And more than that, our author seems pretty keen to let us know that Abraham, we should be thinking about Abraham during our passage. So first of all, in both of the promises that God makes in this passage, he explicitly mentions Abraham, the promise that I made to Abraham, Abraham's faith, Abraham's obedience. Also, when we get to verse 15 in chapter 26, you see the specific mention of Abraham's wells. So all the wells that his father's servants had dug in the time of his father Abraham, the Philistines stopped up filling them with earth. And again, in verse 18, the same is mentioned. So our author wants us to think of Abraham. This is not an accident, this is deliberate. This is revision. Remember what happened to Abraham. Well, have a look and see how Isaac gets on here. It's the same king. And so when we go to Abimelech, we see why Abimelech is so scared of what Isaac has done to him. In verse 3 of chapter 20, God came to Abimelech in a dream one night and said to him, "You are as good as dead because of the woman you have taken. She is a married woman." That's Abraham's wife, Sarah. "You are as good as dead," God says to him. So when God appears to you and says, "You're as good as dead, buddy," that helps you to take note. And when you see the same thing happening again, well, there's a little bit of fear and trepidation. It's not that Abimelech's particularly moral, it's that he's terrified. He's terrified. But God uses this, and this is the marvel of it. Whereas in any other situation, you might think a king who'd been lied to would just simply put the man to death, would take all of his possessions and his wife anyway. In God's sovereignty, he's worked it that not only does his life get spared, but that he's actually got a king's order on his life that says nobody can touch him. He says in verse 11, "So Abimelech gave orders to all people, anyone who molests this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." The exact reverse has taken place. Instead of the king's wrath, he has protection from the king. But Isaac's failure here is to act according to his faith in God's promise. But God intervenes in such a gracious way. And in his divine sovereignty, orchestrates it that he comes away with not only having his life spared, but with an edict that will protect him while he is in that land. And remember, God is the one who said to Isaac, "Stay there." And God arranges that he will be safe while he's there. Then there is another trial that comes upon a time of pressure on Isaac's faith, which is that he faces a little bit of persecution. So we've had the famine, we've had the fear of Abimelech and the fear of the Philistine men, the fear of man, and now persecution. And so in verse 15 of chapter 26, we see, "So all the wells that his father's servants had dug in the time of his father Abraham, the Philistines stopped up, filling them with earth." Well, why does that happen? Well, in verse 12, Isaac planted crops in the land, and the same year reaped a hundredfold because the Lord had blessed him. The man became rich, and his wealth continued to grow until he became very wealthy. He had so many flocks and herds and servants that the Philistines envied him. Now, can I remind you, it's a time of famine. So to get a hundredfold return on your crop is nothing short of extraordinary, of miraculous. There's a real mark of blessing on Isaac's life here. But that is sort of the thing that's getting him into trouble, because everyone else is looking at that and is envious of it. And so they sabotage him by going around to his wells and stopping them up, filling them with earth so they can't be used anymore. And that's quite a serious thing to do someone. I mean, remember that wells, not only were they necessary for life, if you had flocks and herds and things like that, you needed to give water to your animals, to your servants, to your family, to yourself, but also wells were kind of political strongholds. They were places for meeting and greeting, for discussion, for negotiation. They were spheres of influence. They showed territory in a way. And now they were being attacked. But not only that, in verse 16, the very next verse, Abimelech said to Isaac, "Move away from us. You've become too powerful for us." It's not only the Philistines, but Abimelech is starting to get really nervous about Isaac now. And he says to them, he says to Isaac, "Get away. Leave." And he cuts him off, really. He isolates him. "Look, we can't have you here. There's too much of a threat for us. You've got too much wealth and possession. You're almost as strong as we are." And so he sends him away. And Isaac's under pressure again. And everywhere they move, they discover wells, and the wells are, and the Philistines will argue with them over the wells. And then eventually, not far from the forefront of Isaac's mind must be the thought, "Where is this all heading? I'm in trouble with the Philistines. They don't like me. They're jealous of me. We're quarreling over wells all the time. Abimelech, the king of the area, has sent me away and feels threatened by me. Where is this all heading?" And so Abimelech does do what Isaac fears. He rides out to him. He rides out to him. And he brings his general, and he brings his minister of foreign affairs. And he rides up to Isaac, but instead of threatening him with war, he says to him, "Let's make peace. Let's make peace. You're a mighty man. You're blessed." So in verses 28, he says, "We clearly saw that the Lord was with you. So we said, there ought to be a sworn agreement between us and you. Let us make a treaty with you that you will do us no harm, just as we did not molest you, but always treated you well and sent you away in peace. And now you are blessed by the Lord." And Isaac made a feast for them, and they ate and drank, and the next morning the men swore an oath to each other, and then Isaac sent them on their way, and they left him in peace. Everything was heading for war. Everything was heading for conflict. And somehow, it ends up with peace. It ends up with peace. Now, there are three key themes that run through all of these struggles, all of these times of pressure on Isaac's faith. And the first is this. The first is our weakness. The weakness of Isaac. The compromises he makes. The lack of faith that he has. And going back to the beginning, that is our problem, isn't it? That we fail to act according to what God has promised us. And we know that this promise, that God will be with us, that God will bless us, is a promise that is for us who trust in the Lord Jesus Christ. And yet we fail to act according to that. So when we're put in a position where things where we need to, if we do what is right, we face losing, we face danger, we risk. It's so easy for us just to make that little compromise. And when a good friend would ask a favor from us, who really needs our help, and comes to you and says, "I've never asked you anything before, you know I've done a lot for you. Would you just help me out with this one little thing?" And what he asks you to do requires a moral compromise. Just a little lie. Just something, even if it's small. And the temptation is there, I'm going to lose my friend if I do what is right here. Do I believe that God is with me? Does that empower me to do what is right, even when I know I'm risking something important to me? Or when living as a Christian, as sharing the gospel with someone else, or refusing to do what is immoral could get you fired. It's hard to get a job in today's economic climate, and very often people are put in positions that might compromise them. And even if it's not something that's coming from above, I mean, I heard just the other day of someone who was openly ridiculed by their senior employer of 20 years, openly ridiculed for their Christian faith. You're not likely to get a promotion, are you, if that's how your boss feels about you? Or if your boss comes to you and says, look, I just need you to tell this very little lie. You wouldn't put it that way, but just need you to tell this very little lie about that mistake that we, as in I, made. And if you do that, then I'd really appreciate it. It's easy, isn't it, just to go along with that? It's just a little lie no one will ever know. Just a little bit of a compromise. But there's a lot at risk. Or when you have an argument with your wife and you're in the wrong, which in my case is what normally happens, and you need to apologize, and you know that's the right thing to do, but there's a lot of pride at risk in that. You want to win the argument. Do you know the right thing to do is to say sorry? It is easy to fail to do what is right because our belief in God is under pressure. It's under pressure. It's not just with that. It is not just with the little things, the nitty-gritty of life. Think about the big picture. The number of people that I know, that I have that I have ministered to, that I have seen in youth work over the years, and in working amongst younger people, particularly this is a problem for them, is the lure of what it means to be accepted by their friends, to be popular, to be one of the in crowd, and also to be lured away into a lifestyle that says you can do whatever you want. It's a lot more fun to get drunk, to take drugs, to have the party lifestyle, get with as many girls or boys as you like. And somewhere along the line, you've got to make that choice. And sometimes pressure doesn't come from the outside. Sometimes pressure comes from the inside. It's fighting what you want to do. Does your faith stand up to that sort of pressure? Or the option of career. When I know that taking a certain job or moving to a certain area so I can have a job is going to mean that I'm not going to have either any time to invest into my relationship with God, my relationship with my family, my relationship with others in the church. I'm not going to be able to serve my own local church because of my job. I may not even be able to have a local church that teaches the Bible because of the area where I work. But the lure of career, of climbing that ladder, can draw us away, can cause our faith to crack under pressure. But here's the next big theme that comes through in this passage, is God's faithfulness and His grace. We've seen that, haven't we, time and time again. There's a famine, and he says to Isaac, stay there, and later on Isaac reaps a hundredfold. God is good. Even when Isaac gets it wrong and he lies and gives his wife over to some other man, or is willing to at least, God is gracious to him and works in and through and behind the scenes and brings it about so that not only does he escape with his wife, but he is secured safety by the king. And when he's facing trouble because of his relationship with God, because of the blessing he's enjoying, and there is tension and persecution and hostility and ostracization. Is that how it goes? That's right. Yeah. Because and on account of our faith, God is there. And even though everything is moving towards war, God spins it around and makes it about peace. And he walks away with a treaty, a covenant between himself and the Philistine king. God is faithful. God is gracious. Isn't it astounding that Isaac is still in the covenant after the stunts that he pulls? And that Abraham, his father, did the same thing twice. And yet God still refers to him as the one who obeyed my commands, verse 5. Kept my requirements, my commands, my decrees, and my laws. Now that's a bit weird, isn't it? Because God says, I'm going to be faithful to you on the basis of Abraham's obedience. But we've just seen, and our author deliberately wants us to remember Abraham's failure. So how can he say that? When we know Abraham isn't perfect and didn't keep everything all the time. Well, here's a thought. Just a thought. That the reason why Abraham is regarded as faithful here is because his sins are remembered no more. Because when God thinks of Abraham as the one in his covenant, he doesn't think of when he betrayed him. He doesn't think of when he lied. He doesn't think of when he gave up his own wife. He doesn't think of any of the failures. What he remembers is how Abraham was willing to sacrifice his own son in obedience to God. And that, those two themes, our weakness and God's faithfulness, are the gospel, the good news. And when we go to Ephesians and we see the work that Jesus has done, and says, by grace you have been saved, through faith, not by works, so that no man can boast. If it were by works, no one would make it. If it were by works, who could have relationship with God? If we had to keep ourselves in relationship with God by our works, then who would make it? But this passage tells wonderfully of how, because of Jesus' death on the cross, which we'll see later on, how this promise made to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob goes all the way through to Jesus, who is the faithful offspring of Abraham, who does keep all of his commands, who dies in our place so that we could go free, so that we could be a part of his covenant people, be in relationship with him without fear. Without fear of his condemnation, even though we are weak and he is faithful. Let's pray. Father, we thank you and we pray.